have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoud Sabbagh, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop stores. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We will continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States.
It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Volkan said that political will shown by the General Assembly on Palestine must be used to force the UN Security Council for the resolution of this long-standing problem. During the 11-day Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, the United States blocked several attempts by other members in the UN Security Council to pass a resolution against Israel. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi briefed the UN General Assembly President about the current situation in the disputed Kashmir region. Kashmir remains a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since 1947. Both countries fought wars and held dialogue, but have so far failed to break the stalemate. Among other issues that came up for discussion during the visit of the UN General Assembly President include the current situation in Afghanistan. Both sides agreed there is no military solution to the Afghan war and that all sides must seize the current opportunity for a peace deal. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
To some, it's the most anti-Israel country in Europe. To others, the most pro-Palestine. Ireland, a nation of nearly 5 million and a member of the European Union. Days after a ceasefire ended 11 days of fighting set off by Israeli provocations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, Ireland has become the first EU member state to condemn Israeli settlement activity.
The Dáil has unanimously supported the Sinn Féin motion, which recognizes that Israel has illegally de facto annexed large portions of Palestinian land, which is totally illegal in international law. So this is a momentous decision.
The parliament made other decisions too. It stopped short of adopting an amendment from small left-wing party People Before Profit that called for the Israeli ambassador to Ireland to be expelled.
Although it's disappointing that we have seen that we haven't got the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, we still have to focus on moving forward with other matters. But in saying that, there's absolutely no support for the Israeli ambassador being in Ireland within the general public. I mean, that's evident across all social media platforms.
The latest move is one of several in Ireland to support the Palestinian cause. The most recent examples, the 2017 hoisting of the Palestinian flag over Dublin City Council to mark 50 years of Israeli occupation, the funding of multiple developmental and humanitarian projects in Gaza, and the 2018 introduction of the Occupied Territories Bill. Still to become law, the bill hands down hefty fines or jail sentences to anyone found guilty of importing or selling goods originating from the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem al-Quds, or the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Slammed by Israel as an expression of full hostility, the bill and the latest condemnation are considered massive wins for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What has helped foster Irish solidarity with the Palestinian cause? The country's own experience with British colonialism.
The Irish people's bloody struggle for independence from British rule has inspired an emotional connection with the Palestinian struggle, a connection that continues to inspire them to support the Palestinian cause and call for an end to the conflict through Palestinian self-determination. Said Huriza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Said Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Sheba Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolezki, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of you know, people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudan, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. So, trying to control public order or trying to control public dissent. These are The two sides of the UK police crime sentencing and courts bill proposal. Those who support the bill say that this will give police added protection during growingly more aggressive protests. Opponents say it is a new weapon by the Johnson government to stifle dissent and to create a more totalitarian system in England. Well, we're going to take a look at this and see the latest and what it may mean on this debate. I'd like to welcome my guests. I'm going to start it off with Ahmed Caballo out of London. Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us. Ahmed, well, fill us in exactly about the pluses and minuses of this bill. What is being said, why it's needed, and why those who oppose it say it's not good for the country?
Well, I'll start off with those that oppose it. They say that it is a way of silencing dissent, that it comes on the back of large Black Lives Matter protests here in the UK. Most recently, last Saturday, we had one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations, 250,000. The week before that, we had 150,000 people just on the streets of London. And they're bringing to question things like Britain's relationship with entities like Israel, with countries like Saudi Arabia, with the racial disparities here in the UK. And the government doesn't want to answer those questions. The government would rather go ahead without any accountability or without any scrutiny. And that's why the Police and Crime and Sentencing Bill is very effective, because it gives the police the power to say where protests can and can't happen, what time they should and shouldn't, they should start and should finish. But more crucial than that, they criminalise people for defacing statues and actually offer harsher sentence for defacing statues than they do for rape. And some are saying at a time where a recent report said 97% of young women have been sexually harassed on the streets of the UK, 80% of all women have been sexually harassed in the streets of the UK, the government are prioritising the wrong thing. They shouldn't be trying to police protests and actually try to police the behaviour of men that sexually harass women in the street, not women that protest against the sexual harassment.
All right. Well, thank you for that update. That's Ahmed Caballo out of London. I'd like to welcome my guests also out of London, author and political commentator, Dr. Rodney Shakespeare. Thank you so much for being with us. Rodney, how do you see what is happening? I mean, what would be the main effects of this bill if it passed in your perspective? Is it simply targeting protesters, or it appears that there are so many other aspects of civil activity that would be targeted with this bill? Can you elaborate?
This pernicious legislation is targeting the protests against major injustices and major issues. It's about targeting the protest against the recent onslaught on Palestinians, on the genocidal onslaught in Yemen, in the creeping genocidal onslaught in Palestine. It's anticipating the public protests over climate. It's anticipating the public protests over what is going to be a collapsed economy. And it's anticipating the protests over the shocking treatment of journalism. And I cite Julian Assange, who languishes in a UK prison because he reported on a war crime, which was the machine gunning of Iraqi citizens from a helicopter.
Okay.
This legislation is the most disgraceful thing that's come into British law for a long, long time. This government is showing that it's now scared of the British public, and it's now trying to behave like an absolutist police state.
Okay, stay with me, Rodney. Let me get the next guest in on this conversation. Out of New York, writer and political analyst Ian Williams. Ian, thanks so much for being with us. Your perspective, why do you think this bill has been proposed at this time?
Well, there are several aspects. One is a lot of it that's in there isn't, in terms of practice, that innovatory. the British police have always exercised far more powers than they're legally entitled to without actually being called for it. You just have to think of the miners' pickets who were stopped on the roads, or even during the Vietnam demonstrations in the 70s, coaches full of demonstrators were turned back with no explicit legal authority. The police have always had a tremendous amount of discretion. The sad thing about this bill is it sort of formalizes this. It basically says, okay, you might have pushed the envelope out before, constables, but now you've got our backing for it. So if anyone is stupid enough to take you to court, we can produce the statute to show that you're entitled to do what you're doing. But the other backdrop to this is, I think that, and it's not just a British thing, it's across the, it's across Europe, is that as, let's say, legitimate constitutional means of effecting change are cut off because the opposition party has been taken hostage by the so-called centre, and the governments are getting more reactionary, there's very little, very few avenues for effecting change or resisting conservative change in constitutional ways. So protests become more and more viable as a means of stopping things. Similarly with the media, as the mainstream media come more under the control of a few barons, or the, you know, where the BBC acts as the mouthpiece of the government in a way that Pravda would be ashamed of in the old Soviet Union, it gets fairly one of the ways that people can show that things are happening is protests. And
let me just understand what you're saying, Ian. So are you saying that because it's more likely that these protests are going to continue and people are becoming more aware, that the government has to basically use more draconian means to stop them even from protesting?
Well, it's a preemptive move because, yeah, they want to punish people for protesting, but these are the means to stop the protests.
Okay.
Look, you just have to look at the scale and depth of the Palestine, pro-Palestine demonstrations over the last few weeks. That is in no way reflected in the political system. Most Labour MPs are scared of being accused of anti-Semitism. Most of the Conservative MPs are explicitly pro-Israeli. The media doesn't mention them, but mentions Jeremy Corbyn's alleged anti-Semitism. But this shows that hundreds of thousands of people across Britain feel deeply about this subject, and they're bringing it onto the streets as the only means of showing it.
Okay.
So, in effect, if you stop those protests, you're silencing a whole vein of opinion.
Mm.
And sadly, one of the points about this is, you know, if you want to be cynical, letting people protest lets them blow off steam. If you don't, then who knows what people will do? This is the whole point about terrorism is what people do when they're not allowed to do anything else.
What about
general.
That, Rodney? Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, what's your take on that? I mean, what do you think would be the effects if this bill passed? I mean, as Ian says, for example, with the recent Palestinian, pro-Palestinian demonstrations in the UK, that's hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets. Now, if this is a preemptive measure to stop that form of protest, what would it mean?
Well, it is an attempted preemptive measure because it's quite clear that anger is building. Now, Ian mentioned the question of Palestine and the shout of anti-Semitism. The Zionists have played the game of conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And now, that one is now understood, and the anger is building. And as Ian is indicating, on all these issues, people are more aware, and they are going to protest, and the government is anticipating it. But the effect will be to deepen anger and to deepen protest. And this could be the precise moment at which the government's support suddenly starts to drain away.
Okay, well, Ian, now critics say the demonstrations in 2020 and in 2021 have threatened the entire system. by even targeting symbols of the whole British system, like statues of Winston Churchill, and demanding a revamping of the whole British system. And this turn in event is very dangerous for the status quo. Your assessment of that?
Well, you just got to look at this ridiculous and frightening scale of it. If a policeman comes up and cracks my skull with a truncheon, he's going to get a medal. If I push a statue over, I get 10 years. I can cause grievous bodily harm to somebody who's not in authority, and I'll probably get far less than 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is an explicitly ideological move to welcome the sort of the fusties and conservatives of the world. And it's no argument, it's no accident, as they used to say. There was a poll, I think, today that showed that 50% of French police were intending to vote for Le Pen. And I rather suspect that the British police force would reveal similar attitudes, just as many American policemen are members of the various, you know, racist and loony right organizations.
Well, let me just jump in, Ian. Let me just jump in. Sorry to interrupt you, Ian, but you just said something very interesting about the police force in the UK or in France or in the US. What is it about in the police force? I mean, the police are technically coming from the regular part of society. So why are we seeing such an extreme element as far as the way they're thinking and supporting these types of crackdown? I mean, at the end of the day, they are coming from the same societies as the people who are demonstrating.
Look, I've been involved in demonstrations on both nose to nose with the police, and I've found many policemen to be very, you know, actually quite thoughtful and progressive. I remember one policeman in Liverpool, we were wrestling at a picket over Enoch Powell, and he wanted to know why we weren't going after for their pay. I said, you can do it yourself. There was a famous police strike in the 20s in Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know what happened to us then? And I said, yes, they sacked everybody and recruited every crook and vagabond in Liverpool to fill the places. And he said, no need to tell me, son. They were my superior officers when I started. So you've still got that level of humanity in the police force. But, you know, there is this idea. It's a self-selecting body. And the police in Britain aren't armed. They don't have impunity. And, you know, they are not going to pull a gun at the first instance. They're very reluctant to pull truncheons. So, you know, it's difficult to make the scale. But on the other hand, they are being given tasks by an authoritarian government. And that includes smashing picket lines, subduing protests. And, you know, there's legitimate things. We don't want mass gatherings with COVID. We don't want lunatics spreading the virus because they're infected with, you know, anti-vaxxer viruses and QAnon lunacy. But there's a question of how you do it and when you do it. Mm-hmm. Arresting all of those women for protesting about the death at the hands of a policeman of another woman the night before really was a stupid public relations. I mean, it's not just authoritarian. It was like the French general said, it was worse than a crime, it was a mistake. And this is what they've been doing. This government has cloth ears. It does not know about civil liberties. It doesn't know about the lives of ordinary people. But what the worrying part is, like Trump and like Le Pen, it has the ears of people. It knows their prejudices and it plays on their prejudices. And most people don't go on demonstrations. Most people don't like travellers or gypsies. And most people think that their civil liberties are much more important than anyone else's civil liberties. And they play on these prejudices all the time. Okay. And the left has often failed because they haven't countered those prejudices to get their own together. They haven't pointed out the real issues. They've concentrated on peripheral issues.
Okay.
But the right to demonstrate is a very significant one. And the key point here is pickets, for example, with trade unions. A lot of this law has already been practically implemented against miners' strikes and other strikes. And I have been on these picket lines in the past, and the police have not always been gentle on orders. Most of the time, they're fairly, you know, tolerant and lenient on these things.
Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, do you think that the protesters have become more aggressive? I mean, because What the government is saying, what the police is saying, is that they need to have this bill passed in order to protect themselves.
That's a lot of nonsense. It's not that the protesters have become more aggressive, it's that the issues have become very much more serious. I mentioned some of them before, and I'd like to take this opportunity to mention another one, which is quietly lurking there,
sure,
and could lead to very considerable protests. In America, legislation is asking that there should be reports on unidentified flying objects. Now, they have already admitted that strange things exist, that they don't know what they are. But what the situation really is that the UK government and the American government have been lying to the public for 70 years. And that is another issue which is likely to explode come somewhere in June or July. They may try and evade the issue and not honour the American legislation. But these are big issues, and it is the scale of the issue. I point to the other one, which is the collapse of the global economy. These are big things coming, and they know they're coming, and they're trying to crush protests beforehand. But they need to think that they have a majority of people on their side, because I think that they're not going to have majority of people on their side, and this could be the turning point for this government.
Well, Ian, I mean, there are expectations that this year in the UK and actually several European countries and possibly the U.S., it will witness growing unrest and protests as people respond to deteriorating social conditions. Do you agree with this possible scenario? And what do you think it means overall? Is there just going to be more of a schism in the society, or your assessment of it all?
Well, I'm not going to go up in orbit with Rodney on the UFOs. However, certainly the global economy is going down into the depths, and at some point soon. And the response of all of these governments is going to be increased austerity. They are going to try and make the poor, make the less well-off pay for the disasters they've encouraged and for the COVID that Boris Johnson has so sedulously cultivated as he pranced around pretending to cure it. So there is a lot coming up the track in terms of protestability. People's livelihoods will go. People's jobs will go. People's state support will go. People's houses will be at risk. I mean, you know, I think that it's going to be such a big problem if people can't pay their rent and can't pay their mortgage, as might well happen. This is before they used to be able to pick people off one by one. I think this is going to happen on such a large scale. We'll get some serious protests. And not just that, but people are getting used to it. They see that if you stay quiet, the government will keep on pushing. If you fight back, you might get some concessions. And it's quite clear, you know, we remember the poll tax demonstrations. It actually turned, you know, this lady's not for turning, but she turned in the face of the poll tax demonstrations, because people in Britain, especially in places like Liverpool and Glasgow, weren't going to tolerate being paid for ordinary people in public housing paying the same taxes as a millionaire in Buckingham Palace. They said it was wrong, and they were right that it was wrong, but they fought back against it.
So Ian, and do you think that people are becoming more aware? Do you think that people are becoming more aware of the social problems and feel that they have no choice but to protest? Or why do we see an increase in numbers on the streets for many of these protests?
Well, look, some of this is a question of reporting. I've been on, in my youth, I've been on nuclear disarmament demonstrations, I've been on Vietnam demonstrations, I've been on trade union demonstrations against restrictions, I've been on picket lines, I've been on all of these things, and they were not reported in the past. A lot of them, people weren't aware unless they actually saw them. Now, people are taking pictures. The cell phones are taking pictures. They're being live cast, so people can't ignore the fact they're happening. So some of this isn't that it's new, it's that it's being seen for the first time. We've got past the unofficial and official censorship to show that these things are happening.
Okay. I'm running out of time. Let me get Rodney back in on this. Rodney, where do you see this going? I mean, if it continues the way we're saying, and with the possibility of the overall societal situation deteriorating, where do you see this going in the UK?
Well, it's a conflux of very serious issues, and they are coming together, and we are going to have a summer of protests. And this government, of course, is Ian says it's got cloth ears. They are and their reaction to that demonstration about the death of that young lady, Sarah Everard, where in fact a uniformed police officer was and is the suspect. We don't understand the significance in the UK when the suspect is a uniformed police officer and it's about the murder, rape of a lady. You're blind, not just cloth ears, you're completely blind, and you should never be in politics in the first place. So a lot is going on, a lot is building, and if the government had its way, they would suppress everything and have no news, no information, but they're making a mistake. I think this is going to be where the boot is on the other foot throughout this summer.
All right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Author and political commentator Rodney Shakespeare out of London, and writer and political analyst Ian Williams out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Cosmologists have unveiled a trove of fresh data, but the measurements do not settle earlier questions about the universe's unexpected smoothness, says David Castelvecchi, researcher, in an article titled "The Most Detailed 3D Map of the Universe Ever Made." Stay tuned for more. A survey of the southern sky has reconstructed how mass is spread across space and time. In the biggest study of its kind, the data provide striking evidence that dark energy, the force that appears to be pushing the universe to accelerate its expansion, has been constant throughout cosmic history. The Dark Energy Survey, DES, collaboration revealed its results in an online briefing on May 27th. And in several papers posted online. The DES team observed the sky between 2013 and 2019 using a 570 megapixel camera at Victor M. Blanco Telescope at Cerro Toledo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. The survey covered one quarter of the southern sky, and its exposures included 300 million galaxies. It's an incredibly powerful data set, comments Catherine Haymans, and astronomer at the University of Edinburgh, UK. The researchers grouped the galaxies by color to get a rough indication of each galaxy's distance from our own. As the universe expands, galaxies that are further away appear redder because their light waves have stretched out to longer wavelengths. That way, the team was able to add a third dimension to its map. Looking further away also corresponds to looking to the past, so a 3D cosmic map provides a record of a universe history. By tracking how galaxies spread out over time, cosmologists can then indirectly measure the forces at play. These include the gravitational pull of dark matter, the invisible stuff that constitutes some 80% of the universe mass and dominates the formation of galaxies and cluster of galaxies. To better reveal the presence of dark matter, the DES team analyzed the shapes of 100 million of more distant galaxies. Because gravity curves space, the cosmologists were able to map large concentrations of dark matter in the closer regions of the universe by seeing how their gravity squeezes the images of galaxies further away, a phenomenon called weak gravitational lensing. We observe our images of background galaxies to be slightly distorted, explained DES member Alexandra Amen in an online briefing. Mapping galaxies and dark matter in 3D also allows researchers to investigate dark energy, the force that's pushing the universe expansion to accelerate. The nature of this mysterious force is one of the major open problems in cosmology. All evidence so far has suggested that it is uniform throughout space and time, and DES has now provided the most stringent test of that hypothesis. When combined with data from other surveys, its 3D map has helped to cut the error margins down to about 3%, says DES member Michael Troxell of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Ofer Lahav, a leading DES member of University College London, says that the result is a triumph for the standard model of cosmology, which assumes dark energy to be constant. This will make it harder for cosmologists to support alternative models in which dark energy is a tangible medium that could wither away in the future. DES also found the universe to be slightly smoother than expected, confirming findings that the collaboration first reported in 2017. Lensing is persistently low compared to what the universe dictates, said Amen, who is a cosmologist at the Kavli Institute for Particle Cosmology in Menlo Park, California. In addition to DES, two other major weak lensing projects have reported a similar puzzling result. The Hyper Supreme CAM survey done by the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan's Subaru Telescope in Mauna Kea, Hawaii, and the Kilo Degree survey at one of the European Southern Observatory telescopes in Chile, led by Haymans. All three surveys have found slightly less lensing and, therefore, slightly less concentration of dark matter than would be expected based on the prevailing model of cosmology. When experimental uncertainties are factored in, the measurements are still broadly consistent with the standard model. Haymans says it will be interesting to combine the results of the three-week lensing surveys into one analysis to get a more precise measure of the possible discrepancy. There is more to come from DES. The latest results were based on its first 3 years of data taking, out of a total of 6 years. Starting next year, cosmology will take a major leap, with two new observationists, the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile and the European Space Agency's Euclid Space Telescope. Both will conduct weak lensing studies of unprecedented depth, and they are going to do this on the full sky, says Haymans.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's far